Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
Welcome back to another Brick in the Wall with Alistair Anderson, Editor-in-Chief of Property Flash, where we try to make sense of South Africa's property market, one crack and one column, and occasionally one crumbling municipal service at a time, as again I'm without water here in Parkview. Now, Alistair, before we dive into the serious stuff, I think it's worth mentioning that we have just won the SAPOA Journalism Award for Digital and Broadcast Media of the Year. So I think officially we're now award-winning podcasters, which sounds dangerously close to being respectable. So I've just got to say a huge thanks to the South African Property Owners Association, SAPOA, and to the judges and to everyone who listens and argues with us and occasionally writes a strongly worded email to tell us that we're completely wrong. Al, what does it mean for you? I mean, and congrats again, because this really all started from a conversation we had on the sidelines of the SA REIT Association conference, what feels like years ago, and here we are winning awards.
I think it's fantastic, Michael. I suppose it's a vote of confidence in what Property Flash has been doing and what you've been doing in property, and just the fact that we started this podcast March-ish last year after SA REIT, which is every 2 years, so it'll happen again next year, I think in February. So that's quite a quick turnaround to be recognized, which I really appreciate. And I think it just shows you that if you've got a bit of intellectual capital around this stuff in podcasts, then you should bring it. But if you don't necessarily have that, then you might end up repeating what you're reading on Sings.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, isn't it? And you've been covering the industry for years, certainly for longer than I have. And how would you say this relationship between the property sector and the media has evolved? Are we still the watchdogs? Have we become maybe a little bit too close to the industry? What do you think?
So I started covering listed property in October 2013, and the first story I wrote was actually on the listing of Investec Australia, which is now called Iron Gate and is part of Burstone, effectively. And then there was a whole bunch of listings happening, you know, the REIT boom. And there was quite a lot of positivity. You could basically print money in a few hours if you're a REIT and kind of any REIT listed. I mean, it was a bit crazy. And then that all kind of imploded with the scandal around Resilience, Fortress at the time. I mean, things have kind of changed, whatever a lighthouse was called then, I think Green Bay. So that was quite rough. And as a journalist, I got a lot of heat for the coverage there. I wasn't the only one. Quite a few people who took, you know, companies on who'd lost billions. So there, I think you know, journalism was quite critical of the industry, and rightly so. And then again, in the pandemic, I think people questioned how landlords are treating their tenants and customers and vice versa. But perhaps in the past couple of years, and because the sector was just so beaten by that scandal and then, you know, COVID and economic situation, people went a little bit light on them. And I think there is probably scope to criticize and not just praise the sector, you know, even though it's having quite a good rally at the moment, because ultimately, these are people that are, you know, well remunerated, and they own assets which are quite reliable. I mean, if you own a shopping center, it's hard to replace it, and generally, it's got a good lease in terms of good, you know, good tenants.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly a fair summation of where we find ourselves today. I think certainly the likes of Nick Wilson, yourself, were very vocally critical during that period where REITs were raising capital at premiums to NAV. I certainly wrote a couple of columns about the fact that the dealership, the luxury car dealership at Melrose Arch, was doing a great trade at that time. But we saw a lot of financial engineering, and I was very critical as well of the boards of the property companies for perhaps taking their eyes off the ball. And it became almost too much about the financial engineering and not enough focus on the nuts and bolts of what you're effectively doing as property managers and managing your tenants, ensuring that you're reinvesting back into the assets so that you can improve that NOI. And I think, and I like to think, that a large chunk of that has washed out of the industry, but it hasn't gone altogether. And one just has to look at the ongoing Mass saga. I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen that Mass announcement. It was late on a Friday on Sins. I mean, that's always a red flag to me. And effectively, the Mass SPV have now signaled there's going to be a change in strategy. They're now going to be considering expanding their investment activity beyond real estate into other geographies. And again, there's no near-term commitment to the resumption of dividends. And a lot of this is contrary to that commitment of PKI, certainly back in August, as part of that offer to prioritize distributions from that development joint venture, which PKI said would position MAS to resume dividend payments. So I still think there's a story here. And again, you know, the JSE have got to come to the party. And it'll be interesting to see what the new CEO, Valdeen Reddy, does about this situation, because I'm sad to say I was very disappointed by Leila Fourie.
Yeah, so if you look at MAS, I think it's been a story since the outset. So that formed in, what, 2008? I mean, it was a group of, you know, wealthy fund managers basically putting money offshore for wealthy South Africans. And, you know, there was the whole, so it's a scandal with Lucas Nakos, who's one of the original CEOs there, you know, where he was putting money in the church and all of that. He became a delinquent director. And so we saw these changes. And as you said, one wonders, you know, was Martin Slabbert kind of just planning to use this as his investment vehicle, not necessarily something for shareholders? And then you also wonder, should it be listed at all? I mean, I wrote an article for Property Flash probably back in about June, where I suggested that maybe this thing should be delisted. You know, and I think cops from Muzzy actually suggested that to me, that maybe this thing should be delisted. Maybe that's best for shareholders. So I don't know if the JSE is ever going to do anything to MAS, if they even know where to start. I think one thing that has been quite clear with the sector, and it's not necessarily always the JSE's fault, but they don't seem very kind of ready to criticize or probe companies that invest offshore. So as soon as they go into jurisdictions that, you know, aren't here in SA, they just, I'm not saying that they're light on the company necessarily, but they don't even maybe get involved. I don't know. It's a good question what their powers are. But if you look at the maximum fines for the JSE, I think it's something like 10 million and 7 million rand. That's, those numbers you probably know a bit better than me. But yeah, so as I said, we've got a new CEO coming in. And it'll be interesting to see if she's put more, what's the word, I suppose, hard-nosed with funds. I know Leila's position, I think, when she came in was, a lot of it was to try to get more retail investors in the sector, you know, after Nick and Newton King. We'd also struggled with that, to be honest. They say there's been growth, but at the same time, it's also, you know, an investment universe that has actually shrunk. People, so Africans are putting their money in other kind of investments that aren't necessarily listed, or maybe not listed on that exchange.
Yeah, well, they're putting their money into cryptos, which is gambling more than investing, if you ask me, if you saw what happened to the crypto market on Friday. But I think, the JSE, in its desperation to stem the delistings, I think they actively encourage these foreign listings. And if you look at the cases in point, you've got MAS, you've got Supermarket REIT, you've got Primary Healthcare. And I think none of these companies should really be listed in South Africa. So it'll be interesting to watch how that unfolds into the new year as well. Let's turn our attention to one of the more polished players in the logistics REIT game, Equites Property Fund. It's certainly been quietly sort of stacking boxes and solar panels. Its balance sheet is looking quite healthy. Well, I think the rest of the market is quite kind of, you know, fighting for tenants and debt extensions. But Equites released some strong results recently. Some important questions, I guess, about growth and yield and what happens when the logistics boom slows. But I've got to say, Equites is one of those, along with Spear, maybe Vukile, that I think are worthy of another look in the REIT space.
Yeah, so what is quite interesting is I noticed when they put the results out last Thursday, share price actually fell 1% on the day. So it seemed perhaps the gains had already been enjoyed, you know, over the past few months. I mean, the share is up about almost 20% on a six-month basis. It's 10% year-to-date. So I guess what we have there is people trust the management team. So you've got Andrea Taverna Turrison, who's been in this game, I mean, for a long time. You know, he came and listed the fund in 2014 with his partners. I remember that. So, yes, people trust him. They trust Leila Razak, you know, sitting there, the FD, there's Rion Khos. So it just seems like people believe in the product again. It's assets that are hard to replicate. You know, you've got Puma's, that's where their warehouse effectively is. So this is high-end logistics, top tenants. I know they try to get quite a few medical ones. They've got a relationship with Simba and obviously things with, I'm right at ShopRite. So, yeah, it's a fund that's generally done well in the 11 years since listing. I know it really ran hard with like double-digit or close to double-digit returns at the beginning. Then it tapered off a bit during the pandemic. And their voyage into England wasn't completely successful. And I think what kind of upset them more was that Andrea, I mean, as far as I know, he's from Zambia. He's got Italian roots, but he's also spent time in London. So I think he expected it to do better. But maybe maybe just as investors, we sometimes got to cut them some slack and say, okay, that didn't quite work out, but the fund, is still holding strong. And not every South African that goes abroad is going to succeed.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And I think often it just boils down to whether or not the market does trust the integrity of the management team. And Andrea's certainly garnered that over the years. Just broadly speaking, we're in halfway through October. Can you believe it? I don't know where the year has gone. Already, I'm starting to struggle to get certain people to commit to things. It feels like we go into December holiday mode earlier and earlier every year. Gold and equity, I think it's Gareth Elston, in a recent note, warned that there are cracks starting to form, despite the sector holding quite steady. And on the other hand, and as we covered at the SAPOA conference, there seemed to be a lot of optimism. Rates are easing. The market has a 97% call on the Fed cutting at its next meeting, so that'll give the SARB more space to cut. Inflation's moderating. There are some signs that we're starting to see a turn in the South African economy. If you look at new vehicle sales, if you look at our agri sector as well, how do you read the state of the listed property sector at the moment?
So I don't know if I'm as optimistic, a lot of these analysts will tell you and CEOs, but of course they're selling a book.
Yeah,
I think I've got a bit of mild optimism, but I'd also like to see, again, management teams perhaps be a bit more bolder with what they do. I don't know how easy that is. So perhaps there needs to be some consolidation. I mean, some funds, as you say, should have never listed, but even some local ones are so illiquid. And you just wonder, are the opportunities, acquiring their assets? I mean, if you look at some of the largest property stocks, on the exchange, some of their share prices haven't really done that much in never mind that period with COVID, but just over 10-ish years or 10 to 15. I mean, I remember, so it's a former listed FD who said, if Mark Wehner was still alive, he would have tried to buy Growthpoint from Redefine. So
yeah,
I just wonder if we need a bit more of that to kind of get, as you said, larger market caps, more liquidity, because then you're going to attract, these other investors. I remember Ian Anderson coming on to, the show last couple of weeks ago, and also I spoke about this at SAPOA itself, saying, yeah, but you'll find that these fund managers have maybe 3% allocated to property, and it used to be 6. But that's still really small. And considering that property is supposed to be, and it's a secondary industry, but like a large part of our economy. So it can't only be that these guys are pumping money into, banks, tech, retail. So I just wonder, maybe they need to be a bit bolder, but I suppose also connected to that is what all younger kind of investors do, guys, early 40s, who maybe worked at a fortress before and now trying something themselves. I mean, there's a guy like Alon Kirkle, who's ex-Gemgrow, and Arrowhead, who's amassing a portfolio, I've noticed, and he's trying to do refurbs. So there are people doing interesting things, but I guess the question is, when do they get to a state of actually listing it? So perhaps the closest one is like Growthpoint Investment Partners, and announced last week that they bought Aurea, which is a senior living development. We actually had Barry from Aurea on the podcast, as you remember, beginning of the year.
And they've also got that purpose-built student accommodation part of their portfolio. Yeah, there's obviously NASFAS as a risk.
Could they list it? It's because I remember him saying back in 2016 when they launched the healthcare thing, which is quite a while ago now, it's going to take a few years. And then I think he said recently in some media, perhaps another 2 years before they consider a listing. But I wonder, is that right? Should it be 2 years? Is that just Growthpoint being conservative? I mean, they do generally have a history of being conservative. I think the V&A deal was very good, but maybe also got a bit lucky there.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's where we'll leave it, Al, to award-winning journalists. It has a nice ring to it. One slightly heavy trophy cabinet and a property market, I think, still trying to find its footing, given everything that we've just unpacked. A big thanks again to SAPOA for recognizing journalism that tries to dig a little deeper than the press release, and to our listeners for sticking with us through every yield curve and vacancy rate, and for our load shedding block as well. I'm Michael Avery, he's Alistair Anderson, and together we're just trying to put another brick in the wall.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.